This is episode 3 of the Erie Listener Podcast with Jay Stevens.
And John Linvay.
And we got a pretty cool show today, especially we had a wonderful interview with Billy Sabatini, the chief mate on the Niagara.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It's an awesome interview. You guys are going to love it. So, I don't know. We don't want to spend too much talking our usual bullshit, but what the hell? What's on your mind, John?
I don't know. I have a lot on my mind. Some of it's like sort of negative, so I might sidestep that because it's
really come on. What's the negative?
I don't like bullies. Let's talk about bullies.
Okay.
And bullies are the worst because they say things as if they can get away with them, and probably because they're used to getting away with them. But then once they are confronted with either a person or a pair of people that don't like it when people are bullies, it's always really frustrating because how do you make it apparent that you're not going to put up with their, you know, their shit, for lack of a better word, without being the first bully? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, a bully is someone with power too, right? It's not just some schmo being a jerk.
It's like a boss being a jerk.
A boss or someone who's on the school ground, who's bigger or has a larger following than you do or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, that, I think that. To me, that's the worst part about a bully is that power that they represent.
It's weird. I mean, I'm sure many people have experienced this where you leave a job, right? And it's not – there's no malice. It's just you got a better job.
Yeah.
And you go and tell your current employer, hey, I got this other job.
Yeah.
And they take it personally.
Yeah.
That's always the worst. And, you know, it's just what it is. It is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've had that happen to me personally before. And it's always a drag because it's just like, no, it's really like, it's just not for me. Like what I'm here, I'm doing, it's just not great. And I'm not really enjoying it. It's nothing really against you guys. It's just, I know that I would enjoy somewhere else more. Don't need to get all mean about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a shame. That's a bummer. That kind of stress really, I hate that.
Yeah,
I hate
the
job stress sort of permeating your life.
Yeah,
and especially it's not yours.
It's
your partner's.
That's the worst thing is like one, it's stress that doesn't need to be there. There's no reason for the stress to exist.
Right.
And then two, it's not even like my stress. It's stress that's coming through my wife, which I'm sure many people...
And you can't cure it. You can't just make stress for your partner go away. And that's a terrible feeling.
Yeah, and it is. It is literally the one of the worst feelings in the world.
Yep.
And, you know, it...
Worse is a child stress who's dealing with something like that. And you can't do anything about it, or you have limited control over it. That's the worst.
Yeah. I could definitely see that. Especially when it's stressful, like they don't really know what's necessarily happening or comprehending it or learning how to deal with something for the first time. I'm sure that's probably eats you up inside. Because that's what it is. It's eating me up. You know what I mean?
I had one of my kids had a problem with a teacher at school sort of over the course of the entire year who's kind of a bully.
And that's the worst.
Yeah, it's... You know, what can you do, right? You can, I don't know. It's sort of a helpless feeling.
Because you don't want to compromise yourself by being like the bigger bully, but because you want to do the right thing. We're like, hey, can you not be a bully? But then when you say that to a bully, what do?
Right. They get defensive.
They become even a bigger bully.
I don't think anyone, that's the thing. I mean, what's interesting from, you know, let's be empathetic for a second here. From a bully standpoint, right, what they may be doing, they may not perceive as bullying.
Right.
So when you confront someone, it's same with someone who's says something that's racist, but they're not aware of how it sounds or what it comes across as, and you sort of confront them about it, and they get defensive because they don't think they're racist or they're what they say. And they may not be. People say stupid things. I mean, I do all the time, and you know, you just do. It may not be who you are. So I think confronting someone is a delicate situation,
right? Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, because there's so many topics now, too. Like, you think racism is still, like, a big thing. You know, there's, like, the sexism.
Yeah.
You know, a big thing that that is kind of part of what I kind of deal with primarily as being, like, growing up as a gamer and as a consumer of media.
Oh, yeah.
Is, like, the big thing is misogyny or rape culture. You know, where, like...
Especially online stuff.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
It's really, crazy. Really bad. Yeah. And it's, like...
It's anywhere online. I used to run blogs in Montana for politics, and I remember... we had a woman come on it was a group blog, Left in the West, and we had different guests, not even guests, but like we would have a stable of writers who would be putting output. And then once we had this is during the primary between Obama and Clinton, and we had a pro-Clinton supporter who I recruited because I was an Obama guy and I wanted to have a multitude of voices.
Right.
And the critique she would get from regular commenters and followers of the blog was much, much different than what I would get. And it was bizarre seeing these people change because their object of derision was a woman. And it's just bizarre. And
it's weird. It's, I mean, like, I always forget sometimes because I guess just from my upbringing or just me thinking about it, I'm like, oh, why would I say things like that? Or why would I even think that, you know? And I just kind of start assuming, maybe just, this is just on me, but, you know, I think of when I have an experience that this is an experience that someone else has probably had. Like, I'm not alone in this world, and no experience is so unique that no one else has ever had this happen to them before. But it always surprises me kind of how sexist the world is at times.
Yeah.
You know, because we've come so far, but then you think about it, like, well, maybe we haven't really come that far at all. You know?
Yeah, it's true. You know, and I think a lot of people don't see it because they assume it's... it reminds me of a story. It's a normative. What they see as normative culture is from a male's point of view, and a guy doesn't see that. It reminds me of one time, again, from a blog post where someone was... another blogger, you know how we have these blog wars and stuff, but another conservative blogger was complaining that the local newspaper had like a section on Native American news. It was like, why do Native Americans get their own news? Like, why don't we have white news? You know, that's totally unfair. Like, it's biased towards Native Americans. And I said, well, let's look at today's paper. Lead story was about a ski jump contest at the local ski area. I'm like, white culture. Boom. The second story on the front page was about the U.S. Senate, right? It's, you know, there are, you know, 99 white people in the Senate. It's an organization based out of an Anglo tradition. It's not like an African American tradition or a Native American tradition to have the U.S. Senate. That's a Anglo culture right there. So what he was missing is that all these normative
things is his culture, right?
His culture, which is white culture, we don't label it as such. We don't say, in white news today, there was a ski jump contest, because to us, a ski jump contest is a normal thing that we discuss all the time. We don't need to identify it as such. And but we have to go out of our way sometimes as a dominant culture, a dominant idea, to include other points of view. And I think that's where he was mad, because he felt that he was being forced as a reader to include this different perspective.
Yeah, it's like it must be really tough being a reader, you know, to optionally read something.
Yeah. This wasted space in the paper because it had nothing to do with him, right? Yeah. So he wanted news that catered to him, and what he didn't realize that was what the most of the newspaper was. So.
Yeah. Yeah, what's eating you up then?
You know, I a lot of my mind today, you know, not so much personally, but just all this stuff with whistleblowers in the government, Bradley Manning's sentencing,
I've been following this stuff, I've been reading up on it, and actually I've been meaning to try and track out down some guys from the Reader to see what the thoughts are. So what are your thoughts on this matter?
The more I read about, for example, the NSA. Disclosures and sort of the abuses of the NSA and the recent Washington Post article that talked about internal audits of the agency and the number of violations it has in its
it was like 4,200
each year, right? And it's just sort of mind blowing. And I don't doubt that the majority of them aren't malicious, right? They're not out there like, hey, let's follow this one guy who we don't have a warrant on, blah blah blah. Although there were apparently some cases like that, but it's a point about the size of the program, the sheer amount of data mining they're doing, the number of addresses they're getting, the numbers, and all these records they're saving.
It's scary,
and how they can't, and they're using private contractors to do this who aren't government employees.
That's even scarier.
Here I am fumbling for words to express my increasing dismay at the revelations of this program. But what really gets me isn't so much that the government is doing this. To me, like any organization, once you get some power and allowance, you try to exploit it as much as possible. What gets me is the role of mainstream media, you know, like the major television networks and the major newspapers, who are critical of the whistleblowers and critical of people reporting on the information that they're disclosing.
That I think that is like the biggest, like, how far have we fallen?
Yeah.
You know, like, where we have media, like, looking at Snowden and looking at Manning and demonizing them for right. doing what is probably one of the most patriotic things, is when they see a wrong to try and say, hey, I think right. this is wrong.
Right.
Which is, I mean, if you really go all the way back, I mean, that's kind of one of the core ideas.
Well, to me, the whistleblower's personality or motives aren't at issue here.
Right.
Right. They're just, like, we've made them the story, right? Whether you know, Bradley right. Manning is now identifying himself as a woman. Boom, yeah. you know, like...
Right. That's more important
who cares?
Than...
Right. right. Than the information he disclosed or the information that was, you know... and I do think there are some boundaries. Like, should some of the stuff not be reported? Definitely, you know, you don't want to report national security information that endangers lives of operatives. I remember the Valerie Plame case.
Right, that was a, yeah.
Yeah, that's an obvious example. And perhaps some of the NSA disclosures are borderline. I don't know the details. I don't know the cause and effect. But that these programs exist and that the – you know, all these things – I think, and the things of Bradley Manning, also much of what he disclosed was also really interesting mm-hmm. and not obviously national security endangering. And it's really important for the public and the media to know. But for me, as a you know, as a journalist who's worked on investigative pieces, the curiosity that I have for a lot of these programs is immense, and I can't imagine being in a position of you know, high-level journalists and not having that same curiosity and or a feeling of outrage of this program, because it does feel like it's violating some sacred trust that we assume exists between the people and our government, and that infuriates me. We should have an honest, open national discussion about these things. Okay. We're not, because the press is – I don't know. Maybe they consider these people their friends, you know,
yeah,
as
I
opposed
mean,
to the journalists that are reporting.
That's
on.
The only thing I can think of, because I mean, I feel like I think you are being too generous calling them press anymore, right? I mean, it's media. Like, they're like a lot of that stuff now is just media. Like the fact that they're switching the conversation from instead of talking about what was released to talking about the people who released them and trying to profile these people, like that's smoke and mirrors. Like that's straight up like trying to misdirect.
But I don't see that as. Deliberate a lot of times.
I think it's a
culture of. I mean, I think these guys are human. They gravitate towards the people they know and trust and like, and usually those are the spokespeople at the government agencies they deal with, mm-hmm. the flacks that run political campaigns. Those are the people they hobnob with. They don't hang out with people in Hoboken and Erie, Pennsylvania. And also, I think, you know, let's face it, consumers like. Stories about people, right?
Right?
So they're catering. This is
that's what I'm saying. I think it's yeah. deliberate. Like, I think it's absolutely calculated. Like, this is going to get them way more money,
right? But I don't think it's calculated as in, hey, this is going to distract from these issues, or hey, this is going to protect this government agency,
right? But that's why I wouldn't call them press, because right. if they were truly press in the truest mm-hmm. sense of the word, they would be going after what is the truths. Remember when we reported on truth. And like things that were the like this is literally what's happening. We're not going to sugarcoat this. This is the thing that happened.
We talk a lot about journalistic ethics and what it is to be a journalist in press. And I think, especially I don't know. I grew up as a kid in the '70s, you know, around Watergate. And there's a sense that, you know, the press is supposed to be this advocate for the people. But you know, in all honesty, like that aspect of the press is relatively new and recent. It has only existed for. A few decades. The original presses that started up in the 19th century were mm-hmm. very partisan, you know, and
right.
not objective. And so these ethics that we talk about, is it like, you know, is it akin to sort of the rise of the middle class after World War II? Is it akin to this sort of democratic bubble that enveloped our country and is now being popped? You know,
yeah, I don't know. I think
it's only a thing that's been, you know, it's going to happen for a few decades and it's gone. I mean,
I think
Fox News
with,
has driven
yeah.
a freaking, you know, yeah. Tractor trailer truck through the loopholes of what it means to be a journalist to completely foul up, you know, the
right.
notion of press that we used to have.
Well, I think a lot of what being press has to do with is how readily available the information was, right? So originally, like, it was very partisan, but the reason why it was so partisan is because there was no real way to get your information out other than starting to start your own paper, right? And then what we had during, like, the Watergate, since having a paper and all that stuff was like that was an institution that was already set up at that point. So now they started to say, now what's do the public good? What's try and do the right thing? Just because, you know, we were fighting a lot of things at the time. It was communism. There was like, all these threats that were coming to America, and we needed to figure out a way to be above it, to be on the moral high ground at any point, because America is the great. And then I think now that information is so easily available, now it's so easy to kind of to bend it and to find the things that you agree with. I think we talked about this before, but like there's this great study that says, you know, the more information that you have access to, the more likely you are to find things that agree with you,
right,
and to ignore things that disagree with you.
Right.
Whereas before, there was only you only had to hear what everyone was reporting on, right? You only had like a few sources of information, so you had to kind of hear the dissenting opinions. You had to read that stuff because that was all that was there. But now, you know, you have Fox News.
Yeah.
If you agree with them, you're always going to agree with them.
Right, and I think part of, you know, I do think, with the conservative radio talk shows and Fox News, there was a deliberate push to create that kind of – it's like issues of climate change, right? You don't have to convince everybody that it doesn't exist. You just have to convince half everybody that it doesn't exist, or at least put a note of uncertainty in everybody's mind so that you can exploit that to. And I think that's what those conservative – media have done, and of course liberals have responded to that.
Well, they
provided their own.
Because they were getting all the ad money, because basically they were creating this show that everyone wanted to watch, even regardless of like it being
there's a market for it too, right? I mean, it's also business driven.
So they had to fight fire with fire.
I don't know what the answer is. I've participated in it. I had a political blog right for a while, which I was doing editorializing from a very particular point of view, right? I do think it's a responsibility of any good commenter or, you know, blogger or journalist or whatever to do research and to base your assertions on facts and logic and reason. You know,
that's so much work.
It's maybe naive of me to think that's a good way of doing things.
I agree.
It's
with
a standard I hold to myself and always have, you know, and I think what happens is when you're faced with all this information, people tend to gravitate towards, well, A, the material and the content they want to read, and B, towards good content. So, my only answer is to provide the best possible reporting. And then you see stuff like this, you know, in the national – I mean, the whole Iraq war is a great example of how the national media completely failed this country.
Right.
And that they haven't learned their lesson since then. I think Hurricane Katrina is a nice watershed moment where a lot of these reporters realize that not reporting or criticizing the government's ineptitude and corruption actually did have real-life consequences for the country. You know, when you let FEMA be gutted, you know, you are going to, without reporting on it, you will see people die, right? I mean,
right.
I think there was a sense of responsibility in the media for that event. I don't know. I feel like on issues of national security and terrorism, it's not so much that they're going along with the government. The mainstay, mainstream media, of course, Fox News will do whatever the Republican Party is interested in. But I think these guys are afraid. They're afraid of bucking popular opinion. They're afraid of taking risky stances. And I think a lot of that is the way that our media is structured economically, that, you know, that most of our newspapers are owned by corporations that don't live in the town that they're reporting on, or these huge media conglomerates also own, you know, GE owns what, ABC and ESPN, and
right.
You know, just it's a huge media organization and corp company, like the CEO and executives of this conglomerate don't care. You know, they want to produce good news, but more importantly is they need to be seen as not extremist, they need to be within the bounds of acceptability in mainstream press. You know, it's just I think that's the problem. And honestly, I have no idea how to solve it. Like, you know,
I think the way you solve it is just, I mean, I don't think there's an easy solution. It's a hard solution. The hard solution is the fact that we just need more people who get out there, and instead of reacting to outside factors for what they're doing, and to rely more on internal factors, right? Like you said, you know, you believe that when you report on something that you should know, you should check your facts, make sure everything's right. And
yeah,
that's the answer. The answer is that we need more people like you to do those things, and then to have them become
voices.
Well,
we need money to do that, right?
Doing that is
essentially a pastime. It's a hobby, right?
Right.
It's not something people get paid for.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, like, because like, even like, was it on CNN? Like, Anderson Cooper and all of them were talking about how like all their like, you know, field journalists, how they're basically just letting them all go.
Yeah, yeah. They can't afford investigative reporting. A lot of nonprofit, ProPublica and Publica and these other organizations are scooping up investigative journalists because newspapers are dropping them. So, there is investigative journalism happening, but it's nonprofit. It's privately. It's funded by donors. You know, and it's nowhere near amount as much money as you could make old days working for the New York Times or the Washington Post.
I think there's
or even the local Erie Times News, right?
I think there's hope, though, because especially with – if you look at the news, not this is weird, but if you look at like the statistics of how many people in my age group or in the newer – like in the younger generations that are not getting cable, who are not even watching TV, but instead are finding their sources of entertainment online.
Right.
And that includes news. I mean, and a lot of like, you know, Democracy Now!, ProPublica, all of these places are setting themselves up to have that stuff readily available and easy
but
to consume.
They don't pay either, right? I mean, there's no money in it.
Well, not yet. But I think in the future when we have this new audience that is seeking out the things that they want and they're not just waiting to be served –
right,
you know, like how kind of cable is currently. You know, you turn on the TV, and you are deciding on what you're being given. Whereas when you look at the internet, you're finding the thing that you want.
Right,
you're going to the market. And you're saying, I want tuna fish today.
Right, but when you have such a wide variety of options,
right,
none gets the concentrated readership that you know turns into a revenue stream. I think that's a big problem in a lot of phases, and especially in the media and. Like I said, maybe it'll take. I don't know what it'll take.
I hope it's cyclical. I think maybe that's what it is.
Maybe it'll be. You know, it's kind
this
of
is
a
this is a dark
it's
period.
A big fucking bummer that here I am wanting to write and finding no
in
one.
The dark
to,
ages.
Your reader pays a nominal sum of money, but it's a newspaper that's ambitious. It's experimental. It's new. It's probably at times living on the seat of its pants. You know, and It's not a lifestyle. So until more advertisers sign up with the paper and support the quality of commentary with dollars, right, that commentary is always in danger.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, time to do a pledge drive.
Let's get
listeners.
You hear
supported.
That out there? Go now. Call up the Erie Reader and buy an ad. this podcast, for example, right now, we're doing this for free. It's a hobby of ours,
right?
Because it's fun, right? But also, we may not be able to do it for long if we can't make it pay because we probably need to do other things too. So, it's a bummer. It sucks.
The need to survive in an ever expensive world.
I don't know. I might run off to sea any day now.
Yeah, just go. Gonna go hop on the Niagara.
Yeah. See ya.
I think it'd be good. He always seems like a pretty rad guy to hang out with on a boat.
Yeah, he's all right. He's all right. There's some you don't actually mingle with the officers and mates much when you're
it's not no bueno.
No, it's not no bueno. It's just they have different set of duties.
When
you're slaving away on the deck, you know, lifting heavy things, and they're charting the course through the shoals, or
you know,
watching the weather radar. That's out of my pay grade. You know. Trimming the sails, and I barely know which rope to yank on. You know, it's just you don't.
How many mistakes did you make? Countless.
Yeah. There's just a lot of ways you can fuck up.
Did you ever get heckled?
They're very good to volunteers. I'll say.
Did you see professional crews getting heckled for messing up?
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
Good.
Yeah.
Happy that shit flows downhill.
Absolutely.
Happy that still exists. It's still a thing.
Yep. Shit flows downhill. There's a lot of yelling and cussing, and if you're not built with a little bit of a crusty exterior shell, it can be very trying.
Yeah. So. Well, do you want to introduce Billy's and then just let go
well,
right into
I
it?
Think we did at the beginning, right? Billy Sabatino.
I think this is the part where we're gonna slide right into the interview.
Here's Billy. Kill it. I don't know if you knew, but I'm actually applied to Perry 200 for a grant to do a blog/podcast of the ship for this season.
culminating in the Perry 200, and they were like, no.
Really? I've always wanted to do that.
And I was like,
I think that...
That's a drag.
Yeah.
The ship, there's so many different things we could do that are outside of that traditional museum historical realm, and it's...
Totally.
Yeah, you can totally...
You can mix... I was going to mix in history and actual seamanship, you know.
Because there's so much going on.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun.
But they, you know, I was only asking for like, I don't know, like $12,000 for a year to do this thing.
Which is nothing.
Which is nothing for these guys, especially when they're throwing
hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know?
Parades and stuff.
Oh, well.
Hey, so the parade?
Yeah.
So in March, the Therapy Dogs United.
Yeah.
Which my dog Bruin is a therapy dog, so I'm part of Therapy Dogs United. Mm-hmm. They asked me if I would help them build a boat for the parade. I said, all right, yeah, I'll help you guys do that. And at first they said, can you just come? No, first, can you come into his meeting so you can tell us how this is supposed to work?
Let me intro real quick. Yep. Talking to the mic so he can do a sound check.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You don't have to get super on it, but yeah, like that distance you have there, that's good. Okay. So if you want to like swaddle up the chair a little bit so you can like be a little bit more at ease, you don't have to like lean into it. We want this to be as comfortable as possible. Yeah. That's why it's in a house, not even in a studio. So we've got beers out and everything.
There you go. But so, yeah, so I went to this meeting and they just wanted information about the ship and how to build the ship for all this stuff. I'm like, all right, I can do that. I go to the meeting. About halfway through the meeting, I finally just said, why don't I just build it? I'll come over. I'll help you guys build the whole thing, and it'll be great.
Yeah.
So I started going over there a couple nights a week, and...
you fool.
We completely, like, we created this brig.
Yeah.
And it's called Scallywag. Which is a little bit odd now because Tim Sedney's boat is now going to be called Scallywag. But so it was all for Therapy Dogs United, and Therapy Dogs United won Best Float. Yes.
I wonder if that was close to the... Because I don't know if you knew, I drove the float for the Niagara.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the Niagara thing didn't start until, like, May.
Yeah.
And had... You know, Walter and Jonah asked me to do that. I would have helped them, but I already started doing the Therapy Dogs United float.
Yeah.
And part of me felt bad because, you know, the other float I was working on won, not for the organization I work for.
Yeah. our float seemed hastily thrown together.
Well, it kind of was.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was super psyched that.
Although Joe was probably the best Oliver Hazard Perry bar none. He won the sideburns contest, right?
No. Some other guy did. I was kind of bummed.
I mean, isn't that like how everything is? Everything's like all the most awesome things are kind of come together last minute. And it's just because like so many people are so passionate about just getting it done that it just magically happens.
Well, the sideburns thing.
Are we recording right now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I've been recording this whole time.
Cool. Excellent.
So the...
It's Billy Sabatini, by the way.
Yes. So the sideburns thing is kind of funny because the crew really wanted to be a part of that.
So they all wanted to have sideburns, or they wanted to help Joe with his?
No, we wanted to be a part of it. We didn't realize that the sideburns thing was going to happen while we were gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have Ian, who has that massive beard now.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been growing my beard in pretty heavily, more so than I have in a lot of years. And most of the crew, most of the guys on the ship, all have like pretty, you know, biblical beards going on.
Biblical.
And
the operative word.
So we're all of us were planning on, you know, coming back to Erie and then shaving everything down and just leaving these massive sideburns.
And you missed it.
And then we found out, like, oh no, it already happened. So
you got to time that better next time.
Yeah, seriously.
Because that would just be incredible. Just everyone coming back on the Niagara, these giant chops. Just, yeah.
Well, it's something that kind of happens on the ship is, you know, beards and ponytails sort of happen.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of funny if you look at people, you know, the pictures of like the first week of the season and then the last week of the season, you know, everybody has like this, you know, all these beards growing out. And
why is that? What's with like the ponytails? Just because that's just, it feels the best. It's the wind in your hair, like all that stuff.
No barbers, not enough money to afford a haircut.
You can't, no one
bit of all that, maybe? I don't know. It's kind of funny. It's interesting because our captain has ponytail and a beard.
Right.
Chief mate, ponytail and a beard. You know, and then for a long time, you know, all the mates had ponytail and a beard. But I think a lot of it is it's just easier.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much easier to...
Don't have to groom it.
Yeah, like the one of the hardest things I went through was last year. I got a really bad haircut, and I got it cut really short by mistake, and I couldn't get all my hair back anymore. And it's so much easier to just put my hair back and leave it.
Yeah.
Than to have to deal with like grooming my hair every day and same thing with the beard. You just let it grow and
put some beads in it, and you're off on.
Yeah, I don't do any of the bead stuff. But.
Well, there's no hot water, running hot water in the ship. Right. Your shower consists of taking a fire hose, dangling over the side, and sucking water on board.
Yeah, you just lash a fire hose right up to the shrouds, and it's fresh water because we're in the lakes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just don't, brush your teeth.
Don't drink it, right?
Yeah, don't drink the water, but you can bathe in it. I mean, people are wearing, some sort of bathing suit or something like that. But.
Some sort of skivvy.
Yeah, so there's something there, but...
Now, your official title is chief mate, right?
Yes, I am the chief mate of the U.S. Brig Niagara, which what that means is I'm second in command. So the captain, he tells me what he wants, and I use everybody in the crew to make that happen. My job is inside the rails. I manage the everyday operations on the ship, and the captain's job is outside the rails, getting to the next port, overseeing the navigation of the ship, all the other mates, what they're doing.
Right.
And my job is to manage what we're doing every day, day-to-day, and then, even hour by hour, creating schedules and sort of dictating and, directing the maintenance of the ship.
Okay. So you're like the nuts and bolts of it, and he's more of like the big vision, like...
Yeah, that's actually a really good way to put that.
Yeah.
So, tell us about how you get where you're at. I can imagine years of, you know what I mean? Just sailing it to figure all this stuff out. I mean, the rig on the Niagara is not a simple...
So. For me, it's a bit interesting because I actually started sailing on tall ships when I was 13, and I got a chance to sail in high school. I actually went to a school called Tabor Academy in Marion, Massachusetts, and they had a 114-foot schooner. So I got introduced to this world very, very early. Mm-hmm. And then when it was time to go to college, I went to Maine Maritime Academy, which also had a schooner that I sailed on, and... I have a degree in small vessel operations with a concentration in sail training. So I do exactly what my degree is for.
That's like rare.
It is. It's one of the only places in the country that I know of you can get this degree.
Right.
So I actually have a degree in what I do. And I've sailed on a lot of different ships, but I was really, really lucky to get the job at Niagara as soon as I graduated. Mm. In 2005, I got the third mate job here. Just at random, Captain Hearson sent an email to my mentor in college saying, hey, do you have anybody with these qualifications? He sent it to me and said, Billy, you got to get this. You need this. This is your job. And I ended up getting the job, and that was in 2005. And I went from third mate to second mate. I was second mate for 2 years. And then in 2008, I came back as chief mate in February.
And you also had an opportunity this past winter to actually captain a vessel, right?
Yes. After 17 years of sailing, I finally got my first command, which in our industry, that's actually a really long time, surprisingly enough. A lot of people can get command pretty quickly, but one thing that was important to me was to truly understand the business. And as long as I'm learning, I felt no real huge desire to keep moving up. But I got the opportunity to get my first command on a ship called Lady Washington. And I was sailing around in Southern California all of November and December, which honestly isn't too bad. Joined the ship in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I was sailing in, Monterey Bay and, sailing in, Santa Monica Bay and San Diego Bay, all the most beautiful places in the world to sail. So it was actually a pretty amazing experience. It was stressful, of course, but...
Yeah, not without its issues, right.
Naturally. Now you're in charge, right? You're the last word.
Yeah, but it was interesting, You never know who you're going to be in those positions until you're there.
Yeah.
And that was something that – it was the same thing when I became chief mate. I didn't know what kind of chief mate I would be until it was my job to do it. You can think all you want, I'm going to be this kind of person. Mm-hmm. I'm always going to do it this way. And I got out to Lady Washington. Now I'm in command. And I didn't know what I was going to be like as a captain. I figured it wouldn't be that much different than being here, but in the end it was. And it was a very different experience, truly rewarding experience too. I enjoyed having the opportunity to have the last say, to not have to, I'm not downplaying or, saying I don't enjoy my job now as chief mate, but you know, when you're doing things, you're always trying to do it in the way the captain wants.
Right.
You know, I am the voice of the captain. I'm the one that makes, you know, his vision of the ship make that happen. And when I was in command of Lady, it was nice because that now it was just how I wanted to do things, and I wasn't trying to anticipate. I just reacted, and it was a different experience, and I really enjoyed it. And I think it makes me a better officer here because of that experience.
Yeah. Now that's on that's ocean sailing, right? How is that switching from the lakes to the ocean after so many years on the Niagara?
It was actually a little bit weird. I was petrified I was going to get seasick.
Yeah.
That was one of my biggest things was it's going to happen. You know, I didn't get seasick on the lakes or the Atlantic or the Caribbean or the Mediterranean or the Baltic, all these different places I've been. I figured the Pacific must be the one. And we came out through the Golden Gate Bridge and we're out in, you know, 8 to 12 foot rolling seas with wind waves on top of that. And I didn't get seasick. Really exciting. But that was sort of my biggest fear. But
yeah.
The ocean is big.
Yeah.
It's very, very big. And
the understatement of the day.
The Pacific Ocean in particular is very big. So you're pretty much always sailing on a lee shore.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
And for people that don't know what a lee shore is, it means that the wind is pushing you onto the beach all the time. Because the seas are always coming, you know, from the west, pushing you onto the west coast. So you're always sailing these huge swells with this big long period, and you have to be able to manage the ship and make sure that, you know, people get seasick all the time out there, yeah. Even on day sails.
Right.
You go on a day sail for a 2-hour day sail and you have passengers getting seasick, and you have to find a way to make that okay and right. Manage it. But it was nice for me to get back on the ocean because, you know, I love sailing the Great Lakes. I really do. It's a challenging thing and it's a lot of fun. But to get out on the ocean again and, you know, to feel like you're on the ocean was really cool.
Yeah. What are the, you know, I've read and heard and experienced firsthand some of the weather conditions on the lakes and things like that. I mean, what are the challenges that the Great Lakes offer that you don't get in the oceans?
You're always in piloted waters. So there's always something you're trying to avoid. You can't just turn down wind and sail for 100, you know, 200-300 miles.
Yeah.
Especially in Lake Ontario and Lake Erie, because they're so much smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get a wind out of the north or out of the south in Lake Erie, you don't have very far to go. It's the same thing on Lake Michigan. If you get a really strong wind out of the west, you turn and you sail, but then you're right on that eastern shore.
Right.
So you don't have a lot of places to run, and you're constantly doing river navigation, and you're constantly in shoal water.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of everyday challenges, whereas on long ocean passages, you're standing your watch, you know, you're just doing whatever you got to do, and you'd be for days and days and days not touching one line on the ship because you're just sailing and sailing on, and it's really, really nice. So
no locks.
Yeah. There's no, yeah. The rivers and the locks are really, really difficult. The Welland Canal is one of the most difficult things. It is I've always said that my hell will be the Welland Canal forever.
Yeah.
You go up the locks and down the locks and up the locks and down the locks. Yeah. It's a
12-hour trip, right? And
yeah, this past time, we were coming up, it took over 14 hours to get through the locks, which is a pretty long passage. Sometimes we do in 6.5, but this one was particularly difficult.
And you should mention, too, that how much work it takes to get through the locks as you're going through it. So.
Yeah, on Niagara, it takes almost a whole day to get the ship ready. We have to, you know, Niagara is 120 feet tall, and we have to bring one of our masts down, which is a pretty involved process. We have to, you know, cut lots of different seizings, which is, you know, the bits of twine we tie everything off with. And then you have to take our yards, which are the things that go across the ship that we hang our sails off of, and you actually have to turn them and cockbill them. And what cockbilling means is you're taking them from horizontal to almost vertical, and then you're turning them. So you have to have everything inside the rails of the ship. And for anyone who's seen Niagara, you know, Niagara sticks out way outside of the ship, all over the place. So everything that sticks out, we have to make inside the rails. So we're pulling the davits that our boats hang off of. We have to pull those off, bring them inside the rails. We have to take the sprit yard, which is that thing in the front of the ship, and turn that so it's inside the rail. We have to lower the anchors down and turn them so that they won't get caught up on the wall. It's a massive undertaking. So every time we go to Lake Ontario, it's it takes a lot. It's worth it because there's some pretty cool things to do in Lake Ontario, but it's a lot of work.
And it's also all by hand, right? There's no machines that are lifting the use the capstan to step the yard, right? I'm not the mast and
Everything is done by hand. Yeah. I mean, we don't. There's no winches on board. We don't have a hydraulic windlass or anything like that. Everything is done with the capstan, and the best way, to describe the capstan is a giant winch, just turned 90 degrees.
Right.
So it's straight up and down. You wrap rope around it and use that to move everything. And it's takes 10 people walking around on capstan bars. And
it reminds me of that scene in Oliver Twist with the orphans on the wheel, right?
Yes. Or I tell people too, when they call the Kraken in Pirates of the Caribbean, they're actually walking around the capstan. Interesting enough, that's not why they would be doing that. But anyway.
That's a good Disney. Segue. I wanted to talk about what makes the Niagara unique, because it is unique in the tall ship community, isn't it?
Yes. Niagara is unique because we're one of the only wooden square rig sailing vessels left in the country. The other wooden square rig sailing vessel is Lady Washington, that ship I was in command of. Both brigs, both made of wood, both fully square rigged. And there really isn't that many. I mean, Bounty was one of those wooden square riggers too. And, there's, Kalmar Nickel and Half Moon, which they do, smaller things, but, we're one of the largest ships in the country you can actually sail on, that everybody can sail on. You don't have to be a, eighth grade student or a, high school student. You can be 45 years old or, 65 years old or 25 years old, and you can sail on Niagara. We're completely accessible to everybody. And that's actually pretty rare in the tall ships community, because most programs are designed for students of a particular age, high school, college, middle school, whatever it is. And Niagara's rig is one of the most complex and complicated rigs in the country as well. It might not be the most complicated. There are some pretty interesting rigs out there, but we sail 5,000-6,000 miles every single summer. So we rig Niagara to sail, and it's something that takes a lot of time, and it's an excellent place to learn seamanship because we're living it every day.
Right. It's not just like a one-day trip. It's like, no, we're going.
Yeah, this is really happening.
You're right.
When you sail on Niagara as a trainee, you're a part of the crew. Mm-hmm. You're not just there to watch the crew work. You're not there to, take high school courses or college courses while you happen to be on a tall ship. The whole program is around being on this ship and being part of our crew. Day one, you're on lookout, you're steering, you'll get an aloft orientation, you're going aloft, and all of that stuff happens, the entire time you're on board. And what's also unique about Niagara is that we can't sail the ship without the trainees. And by trainees, I'm talking not just about, the people that come on in the summer, but it's also our volunteers. We have, in the summer, our volunteers become trainees, but we can't sail the ship with just a professional crew. It's too big. Everything's too heavy. So we have to have these trainees. We have to have these volunteers. We have to have all these people there or else the ship won't move. So it makes us unique that when you come to sail with us, you're not a part of the crew because we're allowing you to be part of the crew. You're a part of the crew because we need you to be part of the crew.
Otherwise it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, it's not going
to
happen.
Now, that's something else that's unique about the Niagara, too, is how many crew it needs to actually sail, right?
Yeah, we have.
Tell us about, why is that? Why does it take more to sail a square rig?
What is a square rig? What does that mean?
A square rig sailing vessel.
I love the jargon, but I do love it, but I need to explain.
And Billy, by the way, should note, is avoiding most of it.
Right. Yeah, it's hard for me sometimes to talk about ships without using a lot of stuff.
I love jargon because I'm always infatuated with those words because they're so either archaic or they're so specific in the English.
Wooden ship jargon is beautiful too. And it's part of sort of a cultural history.
Yeah, the Niagara takes a lot of people, which is the question you're asking, is because Niagara was designed to be sailed by 155 men. Hmm. Now we sail her with 40 people. And when you translate that, we actually have changed the mechanical advantage of almost everything that we have. So our topsail halyards, I'll explain some of the that stuff in a minute here, but the our topsail halyards used to be 1-to-1. So mechanical advantage 1-to-1 is if it weighs 6,000 pounds, you're picking up 6,000 pounds. It was, our topsail sheets were 1-to-1. The halyards are probably 2-to-1 or something like that. And we've changed that to be, 4-to-1 or 8-to-1. And so increasing the mechanical advantage a little bit to make it possible for us to set the sails so we can do it with fewer crew.
Yeah.
But our version of fewer crew is 40 as from 155. And the difference between a square rigger versus a fore and aft rig, all the ships, all the boats that you see sailing on the bay, and Wednesday night jam races or the Sunday spinnaker races and all that stuff, those are fore and aft rig. So you have, a Marconi main, which is that mainsail that every single boat pretty much has in Presque Isle Bay, and a staysail and a jib. Mm-hmm. And the jib is usually the one that's all the way forward. And all of the sails are set on the fore and aft center line of the ship. So if you take the boat and you cut it in half, that line, that center line, most of the sails are set right on that, and in essence, parallel to it. On a square rigger, all the sails are set perpendicular to that center line. So you have the yards, which are those big, huge pieces of wood that are going across the ship. The sails are set off of those. We can turn them, and we can turn them up into the wind a little bit, but not as much as a fore and aft sloop. Right. And most of the boats you see on the bay are sloops.
Right, right.
Sloops, cutters, things like that.
Yeah.
And also, you should mention that the sail plan and the pictures of Niagara are on the website as well, right? There's an explanation of the different sails and the yards and all that.
Yes. Actually, there should be a link to something that GoEri did about...
Yeah, that's
that
right.
That has like the sail plan in there, and it's actually pretty interesting like that.
That's awesome.
But it's, there's 15 sails on Niagara, whereas a similar size ship... And a schooner, which is a fore and aft rigged ship, would only have maybe 6.
Wow.
And they're designed to be sailed with much fewer people. So
what else, actually, I have one other question is, what exactly gives you that mechanical advantage? Is it just materials? Is it just like modern day materials? Like you can use, like, instead of using rope, you're using like things like nylon, things that have us, or like, what is it that is enabling you guys to go from 155 down to 40?
It's block and tackle or pulleys.
Oh, okay.
The simple machines. You have
that's awesome.
The more shivs you have in a block,
right.
In essence, the more pulleys you have, the more mechanical advantage you have.
Right.
So if you have a piece of rope that goes up to a pulley, down to a pulley, back up to that other pulley again, and down again, you're now creating a mechanical advantage. And each time you add another turn from one block to the other block, you're adding another magnitude of mechanical advantage. So if you look at, I'm trying to think of a good example in something that isn't on a ship where you'd use a tackle for something, but it's not, you don't use tackles on many different things. So, but yeah,
pinata?
It's, yeah.
'Cause in essence, a tree branch is a, it's a block and tackle.
I mean, it is, but that'd be a single whip,
yeah.
And there's no mechanical advantage in that. You'd have to add a block at the bottom in order to create that mechanical advantage, because you have to have a moving block. It's hard to describe without drawing pictures.
our physics lessons for the day.
It's something where you just, the more rope you add and the more pulleys you have, in essence, attached to one piece, the easier it is to pull up.
Yeah.
It's kind of the best way to describe that.
Yeah.
Also, I think another interesting thing about the ship is that makes it unusual is that it is a reconstruction of the Niagara, the ship that essentially won the Battle of Lake Erie in 1813, 200 years ago. But talk about the draft of the ship and why it's sort of odd compared to, it's not like a ship made to be fast. It's not a ship that's... we find it beautiful, but like compared to a svelte design that would hold up in high seas, it's kind of a misshapen little craft in a sense.
Yes, absolutely. Niagara was built for the Great Lakes only. She wouldn't. She really is not designed for being on the open ocean, because she only, when she was originally built, only had a 9-foot draft. And what that means is that from the waterline down to the bottom of the keel, which the keel is the bottom of the boat, it's only 9 feet. And for a ship that size,
we're talking 120-foot masts, right?
So yes. So
the proportion is pretty.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And we have now added a 2-foot ballast keel, so now we draw 11 feet. But still, a ship of this size would be drawing something like 14, 15, sometimes even 18 feet. The Charles W. Morgan in Mystic, Connecticut, is roughly the same size as Niagara in terms of, length, but she draws way, way more. So, you have this very, very shallow draft, but super wide. Niagara is, 34 feet wide.
Wow.
So, I joke sometimes that she's, she was designed to be a floating gun barge.
Yeah.
Because she was designed to carry as many guns as possible, to go sailing once. And if you win the battle, great. You have control of the lakes. Right. And if you lose, you don't really want to give the British really that great of a ship. So she was built with green wood, which means, the wood hadn't dried and cured yet. Mm-hmm. So it was still moving and drying and doing all kinds of weird things. And so when it came time to build this Niagara, it is a reconstruction of that original ship. So it comes with the difficulties that are with sailing a ship with shallow draft. And, so we have to be mindful of that all the time. And what's actually also interesting in calling Niagara reconstruction, she's not a replica. A replica is when you don't have the ship anymore and you're trying to build something that resembles that ship. Niagara has been in existence since 1813, somewhere. Granted, she was on the bottom of Misery Bay for 92 years, roughly, before they brought her up again and rebuilt her. But they knew where she was, and that original ship has been in existence since 1813. And when they built this one, there's original parts of that Niagara.
Oh, wow. In that's incredible.
Our current version of Niagara.
Yeah. So Frankenstein.
In essence, none of the pieces are structural anymore.
Right.
They're sistered up frames, throughout the ship. In the wardroom where the officers live, there's, the ventilation, slats have, heartwood from the deck beams and things like that. But, it's kind of interesting.
That's cool.
Niagara's a very unique ship to sail, and sometimes difficult ship to sail because of this super lofty rig on a relatively small hull.
What does that mean? I assume lots of leeway, so the ship goes sideways in the wind pretty easily?
She did actually a lot before they put that ballast keel on.
Yeah.
Once the ballast keel is on, now and the ballast keel is just pretty much, best way to describe it as an ice skate. In order to sail into the wind, you need to be able to have something to keep you from just
flipping.
Not flipping, actually, from just drifting downwind.
Okay.
So when you have that keel sticking down into the water, it gives you a little bit of a bite in the water, and it'd be probably the best way to describe it is a sled. Mm-hmm. When you have one of those little saucer sleds on the ice, you can go in any direction. It doesn't matter what's going to happen. But if you're on ice skate, you're going to go straight the whole time. Mm-hmm. The skate's going to keep you going straight, whereas a saucer, you can go left, right, doesn't matter. So having that ballast keel gives us that sort of skate, and it keeps us from, drifting too far downwind. We still make 10 degrees of leeway, but it's not as much as, Oliver Hazard Perry had to deal with in 1813, or Jesse Elliott, really. Or what Captain Ribka had to deal with when he first sailed on the ship.
Extra keel was put on. Yeah.
Right, and that was done in 92. So,
yeah, and also it's a little tippier than an ocean-going vessel, too, right, under high winds and the conditions like that. Is that right?
It's not so much that it's tippier. It's just you can't sail in as much wind.
Right.
Because you have such a big rig, big lofty rig, you have to take in sail earlier. Peacemaker, which is one of the ships that's going to be at Tall Ships Erie, the second mate was talking to me about, they want 30 or 40 knots of wind, and they're totally comfortable with that, and they love sailing in 30 or 40 knots of wind. and 34 knots of wind, Niagara goes to port.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just what we do because Niagara's rig is designed for light air.
Right.
So we can't sail in a hurricane. It just wouldn't work for us, whereas there are some ships that are, you know, practically bulletproof, you know, the ones that went around Cape Horn and things like that, and they were designed for super, super high winds. Niagara's not designed for that. So it's not so much that we're more tippy than another ship, it's just we're designed for something different.
Right, right.
Designed for the Great Lakes.
Right, designed for the lakes right. in the summer.
For one
for,
week
for
of,
one battle.
Of
sailing,
right? Yeah. One battle, yeah. Right. You know, we could go into the history and everything like that, but I definitely recommend if for any listeners, Walter Ripka, the senior captain of the ship, wrote an excellent book about the campaign that covers all this stuff, the history. The Lawrence, which is the sister ship of the Niagara and Captain Elliot, I guess lieutenant, really, at the time.
They were both of them were master commandants.
Okay.
Both Elliot and...
who's actually, right, who's commanding the Niagara at first until...
Yes.
The famous row across the lake with the
yes.
battle flag. Yeah. do you got any stories about, you know, the day-to-day life on the ship? You know, what makes it, you know, what's the sleeping conditions like? What, you know, what's the watch system like?
Well, the watch system.
What's your worst splinter you ever got from the deck?
Oh, I'll start with that one because that's actually really exciting. So on the ship, we have wooden decks and we have to pick lines up off the ship all the time or off the deck. And the splinters you get are actually under the fingernail, a wood splinter. And the only way to get them out is with tweezers, especially if they break under the fingernail.
Yeah.
And you have to perform minor surgery on yourself or other people to get those out. But
or Isaiah telling me about a splinter that went to – you pulled it out, right? That went
yes,
to
yes.
under his fingernail to the first knuckle.
Oh.
Yeah, it was that was crazy. So
I'm super squeamish. So that stuff always tears yeah. me up, man.
It was pretty amazing. He was looking at it, and we were down in the wardroom, and I said, "Do you want me to pull it out, or do you want to do it?" And he's like, "I don't know." And it's like, "What are we gonna do?" And I think actually in the end he pulled it out himself because. He decided he's a tough guy. So another guy though, Michael, I put his hand on top of the capstan and I had the tweezers and I'm holding his hand down. And I looked at him and was like, "Michael, this is going to hurt." And I just buried the tweezers underneath his fingernail and ripped it out. And I've done it to myself too. It's painful, but yeah, that's
one of the joys of tall ship sailing.
Yes. The romance of the sea, as I like to call it. The day-to-day life on board is kind of interesting because we operate 24 hours a day. So it's constantly there's something happening. There's always somebody on watch. Currently on the ship, there's two watches, which are then split into two divisions. And one of those watches is on during the day. The other watch is off, you know, for half of the day. And then at night, we go into one division is on and the other three are off. So it's kind of a complicated system, which actually works well because the more complicated it is, the harder it is to understand. So you just follow the schedule that's posted and you don't think about it too much.
Yeah.
When you can figure it out and predict it, then you start thinking about it too much. So just follow the schedule and it's simple. And that's actually one of the beauties of sailing is you don't have to – this actually sounds bad. You don't have to think as much. You know, you just –
it's routine.
Yes, you fall into that routine, mm-hmm. and you do what the ship needs day to day. You get up in the morning, you do a below decks cleanup. You clean the soles, you clean the heads of the toilets, the soles of the floor. You know, you do a deck wash. You know, the meals get set up, the meals get broken down. You do dishes. You know, you set this sail, you take in this sail, mm-hmm. and you can sort of let go of that whole life ashore. You know, everything that you have that is stressing you out, you know,
right.
whether it's your mortgage or, you know, your car payments or, you know, what's happening to the ozone or, you know,
yes.
whatever it is that stresses you out,
right.
you know, whatever it is that you think about and you're constantly trying to fix or deal with, you get underway and sometimes it actually feels like time just stops.
Mm-hmm. I have to imagine, like, since it is such a, like, a rigorous routine, and there's always something to do, and once you learn what those things are, you can kind of just do it, and then it leaves your mind free to just wander or find Zen. You know what I mean?
I think so.
Yeah,
I mean, it helps. I never feel more at peace than when I'm sailing underway at night.
Right.
Because there's the fewest amount of people on deck.
Yeah.
You're just sailing.
And the stars are out and the sails are up.
Right. You know, I can sit up forward, you know, if I'm off watch, I can just sit up forward, look up, and just listen to the ship sail. Mm-hmm. And it's a truly amazing feeling. You know, it's one of those experiences that so few people get to really truly understand, because, you know, sailing is so much about passion.
Right.
About the passion for the life and the passion for doing what we do. It takes a lot of patience because it's not always great.
I was going to say, you know, the way you've described it sounds very meditative, but it can also be extremely exhausting and stressful as well.
Right, and that's the other part of it. You know, when you're motoring hard into an 8-foot sea up in Lake Superior, which we did this summer, you know, it's stressful. You know, everybody's seasick, and it's tough. It's hard. Or a storm comes in, and everybody has to go aloft and reef topsails or sea stow to gallants, and, you know, everybody's just constantly moving, and you had to get up 2 hours before your watch. Now you have to stand your watch, and you're exhausted. And then you have a port stop right after that. And so there's parts of it that are, you know, absolutely exhausting. But then we come back across Lake Superior and we sailed for like 4 days straight. Beautiful, beautiful sailing every day, every night. And having the patience to go through the stuff that's really, really hard. And to wait for those times that are truly amazing, it makes sailing just this truly, best thing is it's just amazing. It really is to just sit there and let it all happen, because you have 311 tons of ship moving at 8 or 9 knots under nothing but the wind and the sails. Mm-hmm. And that really does, it sort of changes your perspective on a lot of things.
Yeah, and I think it's like what you're describing too is like that collective experience, right? Like everyone's going through this together, and you kind of, and since the ship is so big and it takes so many people, you almost like lose yourself because you become part of this thing that just needs to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah, synergy.
Right.
It's absolute synergy. You know, just like you said, the collective work to make the ship go.
Right.
And when it all clicks and it all happens, and you can look around and say, we did this. We did this together.
Yeah.
It really, it makes you feel like it's the only place in the world to be. And so, but then there's the other times, you know, there's a good quote is, you know, sailing, you know, sometimes it's the most beautiful thing in the world to see and the most beautiful thing in the world to be. You know, other times, you know, you feel like death, and most of the time you're just hungry.
Yeah.
So,
so you know, it's a good segue into talking a little bit about the eating in the galley, and also probably what's really interesting to most folks is, you know, where do you stash these 40 people below decks? I mean, the draft is pretty shallow, so below decks is not, you know, unlike a lot of other tall ships, it isn't really easy to get around.
Yeah, it's only 5 foot of, headroom underneath the deck beams. So, what Jay's talking about is everybody sleeps in hammocks too. So, not everybody. The crew sleeps in hammocks on the berth deck. You fit up to 30 people in there.
The berth deck's just this
large open space.
Yeah.
You know, it's a 30 by 40 space. And you just fit all these people inside this one space swinging in hammocks. And it sounds crazy. And it looks crazy when you actually see it. But people can actually sort of embrace that hammock, and once you climb into your hammock and you're in it, you're now in your personal space. Mm-hmm. Now you're in your bedroom, and people, one, are not going to bother you, and as long as you can tune that out, you're fine.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of people ask me for canvas so they can make a hammock to sleep in their dorm room or something like that. That's college. The officers, now we have cabins. We sleep aft. In our own cabin. So I have a cabin. It's nice. I sleep in a bunk, you know.
What size is your cabin? I mean, we're not talking about a huge.
Just like your closet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much a closet.
With a door.
Yeah, it's a closet with a door and a bed. So most people look at it and it's like, oh my God, you sleep in here? I was like, what are you talking about? I have the best cabin on the ship. So people are like, no, you don't. Like, no, really. Trust me.
Yeah.
This is what you get after you sail for 18 years.
Right. There's next to no privacy on the ship.
Right, almost none. There's no privacy and you're never alone. Ever. It's very hard to find time to be alone. So sometimes that's an asset. Sometimes it's sort of a detriment because you just want to be alone. Because even when you do lay in your hammock, if you're not in a good space at that time, you do feel like you're surrounded by people. And it's a hard thing to deal with. But what you were saying earlier about the being part of a crew, if you can embrace that and you truly do feel like you're part of the crew, you don't want to be alone anymore. You
right.
want to be with them all the time. We've always joked, whenever we, especially here in Erie, somebody meets a girl, meets a guy, and it's like, hey, so what are you doing tomorrow? Like, what do you mean? We just met. Yeah. Don't you want to hang out? you can have breakfast with the crew tomorrow morning, up at the sidewalk.
All 40 of us, right?
Yeah. And then, after that, then the crew is going to go to the beach. You want to come with us to the beach? And then we're going to probably go out again. If you guys want, you can come out with us tomorrow night too.
Yeah.
And it's like this.
And there's they need an extra crew member, so come along, right?
Yeah, then they can sit with us. So, this is great. Glad we met. So it's always kind of that the crew is always together.
We're
always constantly doing stuff together.
I mean, I have to imagine a certain point on sailing, and especially after you've been out for so long, that it's so you transform from being individual people and you kind of become like this mass of organisms that is just communicating without even talking. Everyone knows kind of what needs to happen. You look at the schedule and that's it. And you just there is this giving up of identity and you're kind of becoming this greater thing.
That works,
the ship, that is the Niagara.
Yeah. If we're doing it right, that's what happens.
Right. Well, if they're bad, you just throw them overboard, right? That's what happens.
Not anymore. You can't do that anymore.
grumbling, complaining, discontent is as much a part of the sailor's life in history as lifting yards and hauling canvas. I mean, I've read countless memoirs and it's always the same thing. You got grudges with the mates have grudges with the sailors, there's divisions in the crew, mutinies happen. Yep. In fact, that was the one thing I remember reading from some of these early accounts is how commonplace mutinies were how dangerous sometimes it was to be a mate or a captain on a ship.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard because you have to find that balance. The balance between you're not just somebody's boss. Because you work with them, you live with them, mm-hmm. and then you hang out with them when we get off work.
Yeah.
So you're constantly with these people.
So yeah, imagine those
family,
listeners.
Yeah,
imagine sleeping in the same room as your boss or staying with them for a full summer without losing sight of them.
Or a lot of times in the winter, a lot of the sailors end up living together in houses or apartments. As well. So even when we get off the ship, we still live together. I mean, we're constantly with each other. It never go away. And it's something that's sometimes hard to sort of cope with because you have to be able to sometimes separate that professional from the personal.
Absolutely.
And it's a very difficult thing to do, especially when you become very close friends with these people. Mm-hmm, and then, now you need something done right now. Get up there and go do that right now. And you really have to, forget the personal relationship and concentrate on that professional relationship right then.
Right.
And so sometimes it is tough, but for the most part, people can work around it and make it happen. And that's one of the nice things about working on a ship is that everybody's used to that lifestyle. So we seem to sort of fall into a groove pretty easily.
Yeah, you can call someone an asshole and they're not going to take it personally. You know what I mean? Like, they understand that at that moment they were being an asshole and you need to tell them that because something needed to get done. It reminds me a little bit of like working in a kitchen.
Yes, a lot of people have said that it is similar to that.
Because it's
that super high stress level.
Yeah.
Get this done right now.
Right.
And
I can't talk to you. All joking aside, I need you to do this right now.
Right.
Then afterwards, let's go get beers and everything's cool. But at that moment, we're going to be screaming profanities at each other. And I don't want to like trying to co-opt it, but like, you know, because I've worked in restaurants quite a bit, and it is like what you're describing is like, yeah, because you work together all the time. You're always together. You're always not only are you always working together, but you're always like literally right next to each other all the time, and there's never a
you're
private
in a cubicle,
moment. Right? Yeah, exactly. And yeah, and it's sometimes, you know, when everything's going great, it's cool to sit back and enjoy and yuck it up. But when something goes south, man, it's chaos. It's instantly chaos, and you got to
correct it. And on a ship, the weather is what dictates chaos.
Right.
Yeah. It really does. And that's when, you know, my job as chief mate, I'm the one calling everything.
Right.
So it's usually my voice that's the one that is directing people to go different places. And, you know, it's something you have to sort of learn how to do to be able to project and make it all happen all at the same time. Yeah, and sometimes people, they do get a little bit miffed because you said something too quickly to them. But then as soon as it's over, you talk to the person, you work it out,
right.
And then usually it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something you have to manage that. You have to manage that, you know, the emergency situations.
Right.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So I want your perspective, Jay,
yeah.
As, you know, sailing on Niagara as a volunteer, the sort of the perspective of somebody that has, you know, as a lot of people refer to it as, you live in the real world.
Yeah.
and you come
such
in,
as it is.
And you come to Niagara,
yeah.
And after you're done with Niagara, you go back to the real world.
Yeah.
And that perspective of living in the real world and also living in our fantasy world that is the ship.
Yeah.
that transition of going back and forth, how has that changed your perspective both on the ship and also your perspective on what you do in your everyday life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things I liked about the Niagara is I felt the work was meaningful. You know, when you sit in a cubicle, even as a writer, you're so detached from your work. You know, you show up to work and you do these things on a computer. You type in abstract symbols, and then at the end of the month, you get a paycheck. And but on the Niagara, you know, it's fascinating. The ship is a machine, right? The ropes are the cogs and the yards are the wheels. But, you know, human muscle and bone is also part of that machine. Like, you're up there making things happen, and the ship moves. And not only that, it's I didn't feel the strong sense of teamwork maybe that is sort of idealized ship, but definitely like the crew is important. Like the crew is keeping everyone alive, right? And you're a part of that. Like even the most menial task that you do furthers that mission. And the mission isn't just getting from point A from point B. It's, you know, keeping the thing afloat and not running into a rock. You know, you do your duty, and that's so rare, I think, in work that we do in the post-industrial society or whatever abstract concept you gave. And going back, I don't know, I found it incredibly addictive, you know. And if I weren't married, didn't have kids, I would have given up everything and run off to sea,
which a lot of people actually do.
Yeah,
they sail with us for a couple of weeks, and
like
all of a sudden
Ian Bobo, we talked about, right?
Picked him up in a well, yeah, that's actually an excellent story. Yeah. Quick aside, so we went to Toledo, Ohio in 2007, and this reenactor guy who was like, I think he was probably, I don't know, around 20 years old. He shows up, part of his reenactment group, starts talking to us, and he's like, hey, is there any way I can sail on this ship? And I said, all right, hold on a second. And I went and talked to Captain Ripka, and I said, hey, there's this guy over here. He wants to sail back to Erie with us. And I was like, okay. So we really quickly got all the paperwork done, because there's a whole bunch of paperwork we have to do. Got all that figured out, and he sailed back with us. Pretty much the highlight of that whole trip was Ian and having him on the ship and his super enthusiasm for sailing and being a part of the crew.
Yeah.
And he sailed with us. He had a great time. He went home. 2012 rolls around, and we're coming back into Toledo. And I'm up on the fore shrouds looking at the dock, and I see this guy standing there waiting to catch our lines. And I called the captain on the radio, because he's a lot closer to him. I said, is that Ian Bova? And Wes is like, I don't know. And then he asks him, and yes, it's Ian Bova. So the same thing happens again. Ian says, hey, can I come with you guys again? And I said, well, let me go talk to the captain. So I go talk to Captain Hearson, and he's like, yeah, let's take him. So Ian then sailed with us again last summer, and then we end up hiring him.
Yeah.
And now he's sailing on the ship as one of the professional crew, and he's a top notch seaman and just a super positive guy. And he has a great beard.
Yeah, great beard. And we should add, he's also taking some of the crappiest jobs on the ship, right? The assistant engineer and dealing with the
he volunteered for that position, yeah. But no, he's. He's
that's what I mean. I think that's important when, ponies up to do the job that no one else.
Ian is the type of guy who will do anything for anybody, and he will work as hard as he possibly can to make the ship a better place for everybody.
Yeah.
And he's an excellent guy to have on board. And it was just so awesome to, find him in Toledo, and he jumps off and starts sailing. End up sailing on another ship, the Nina, which I didn't know about. Between sailing in Niagara in 2007
cheated
and 2012.
On you guys. Oh my god.
No, we encourage that.
That's the way of the sailor, right?
But yeah, it's it's a lot of fun with those kind of things. And
I just want to throw in one more comment about sailing on the ship. Like the ship actually becomes a physical part of you. It's just weird. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've experienced this. I remember going home after I did a 10-day cruise on Lake Ontario and battle reenactment, went through the locks twice and had a couple of squalls. I mean, I had a pretty broad experience in the 10 days. But coming back, I remember lying in bed and falling asleep and dreaming that I was on the ship still, sleeping on the monkey deck, which is the little deck at the bow of the ship, and that the curtains in my room were lions coming down from the deck. And wow. I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would see the lions and I would see the mast, even though I knew I was in my bed still. It was a really weird experience.
Yeah, that happens to me too. Just... about 6 weeks ago, I was home, and it was my first night home, and my wife heard something out on the street, and she turned over and put her hand on my chest, and I woke up immediately, and I wasn't at home. I was on the ship,
yeah.
And I was ready to react to whatever situation was happening on the ship right then and right then. And it was just, it was a very, very quick sort of, okay, I'm up. What's going on? Yeah. I'm ready to go. I'll be on deck in 30 seconds.
Right.
Yeah. And but yeah, that happens to me all the time. That sort of, the ship does become, the only way to really experience it, I think, is that way, is to fully embrace it and have it embody who you are at that time.
Yeah.
Eventually, you do go home. And,
yeah. It's kind of a bummer. I mean, it's great to be home, but...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's awesome. Yes.
I love it. Yes. No, I do. I mean, I obviously wouldn't be home if I didn't prefer it to the ship, but...
Yeah, you have to love what you do
in
sailing because,
it's a stressful on your personal life,
Sure. It truly is. So you have to be able to love your job as much as you love being home.
Right.
Because if you don't, it's actually really bad for the ship.
Yep.
So you have to be just as excited to leave for 2 months as you are when you come home after 2 months.
Right.
And if you can balance that out and really feel that way, then you're giving your all to your job and you're also giving your all to your home life.
Right.
And that's something that, I try very hard to balance that out. And a lot of times people at home don't understand it as well because it's hard, because it's much easier on the people leaving than it is the people staying at home.
Yeah.
Because you're off doing new and exciting, interesting things, whereas the people at home are still doing the same things.
Right. Without you, and especially those sailors with families, and there are few.
Right.
There are very few. I mean, who else on the ship besides Wes has kids? I mean, Ripka.
But yeah, the captains.
So rarely.
The captains have kids.
Is anyone else on the crew? Most of the crew isn't even married or even have partners on shore.
Yeah, I'm married. We don't have any kids. The couple of the mates have boyfriends or girlfriends at home that they talk to every once in a while.
Yeah.
But it's hard sometimes to balance how much you love your job in sailing versus how much you love your wife and want to be at home.
Yeah.
And the best way to describe it is you have to love both and you have to want to do both.
Right.
And that's...
And your partner has to be cool then. That's
that's one of the biggest things. Megan is okay with that.
Yeah.
And she's found a way to be okay with that. And it's hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard sometimes.
I think there are people who like the idea of a sailor coming to town every couple of weeks for a few days and then leaving.
Oh, yeah. Well, last year, a good example of this, from May 1st to January 1st, I was only home for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Because I did the whole Niagara season and then went to Lady Washington, so I was gone almost that whole time.
Yeah.
To go back a little bit to the volunteer stuff that we're talking about, the
we should talk about the program because I mean I don't want to interrupt you, but one of the greatest things about it is anyone can walk off the street in Erie and be a tall ship sailor within a matter of weeks.
Yes. And it's a very unique program because, one, it's 100% free.
Yeah.
And all winter long, we do classes, winter sail training classes, where we'll teach you the ways of a sailor. We'll teach you how to sail Niagara. We'll teach you how to furl. We'll teach you the vocabulary. We'll teach you the knots. And it's a lot of fun for me, teaching everything to everybody. But also, it's usually a lot of fun for the people learning because it is sort of sometimes that escape from the real world.
Yep.
And for 4 hours every other Saturday, you come down and now you're a tall ship sailor and you're learning all these really cool things. Mm-hmm. And that transitions into sailing in the summer. And our volunteers, they work all winter long, usually on Saturdays, unless people have the opportunity to, you know, work in, during the week, which Jay does. And all the hours that you sail count towards sailing in the summer. And the way it works is 2 hours of work counts for 1 day of sailing. So if you know, do an 8-hour work day, you can sail on the ship for 4 days. It's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, it's a great deal.
You know,
I have to look into this because that's like, you have basically romanticized it so much to the point where this is all I'm going to be thinking about.
Good.
it's a dirty, dangerous shit job that everyone loves when they do.
Yeah, but at the end, that's a good point. But everybody loves it.
I worked in the kitchen, so I know. Yeah. I think I'm mentally prepared for what's coming up. I might not be physically prepared, but mentally I'm ready.
Yeah, but it is something that you can dedicate yourself to. And mm-hmm. I think Jay put it very well, being sort of almost addicted to the work, to the ship, to the camaraderie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the biggest parts of it is you truly, even as a volunteer in the winter, you become part of this group of people in this team working to make it all happen. And Niagara is worth it. She truly is worth it. I mean, it's, you know, the ship is what it's all about. And we're all working to make the ship great. And you know, the one thing I'll say about our volunteer corps, our volunteers are absolutely essential to Niagara. We cannot operate without volunteers. It is the lifeblood of how we maintain this ship. We could never afford the workforce that our volunteers give us throughout all year long, but mostly September to May, when they're coming down on their free time to volunteer in the ship and maintain the ship. We're in a very unique situation in Erie where we have so many people that are so passionate about Niagara that will come down and do all this work. Mm-hmm. And without the volunteers, the Niagara program and the Niagara itself, the ship, would not exist. It is an absolutely essential part of what we do.
It's very, very cool work too, though. I think that's another unique thing is the rig shop in the basement of the museum. I mean, I don't think there's another place like it.
No.
You know, where we actually build the rigging of the ship, you know, doing the seizing and the serving and all the similar to old techniques.
Yeah, very similar. Yeah. I mean, we've built our lower shrouds and topmast shrouds, which doesn't mean much to anybody, but
it's cool.
All the cables that hold up the mast, mm-hmm. we built them ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Most ships are wire, but on the Niagara, it's that we try for authenticity's sake.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, we're looking for the authentic ship thing, so we actually use Kevlar.
Yeah, instead of
But the reason we use Kevlar is because it's 4-strand set up just like hemp rope and hemp shrouds would have been in 1813. So it's this really, even though it's this literally bulletproof rig, it looks very similar to what the rig would have been in 1813.
Right.
But our volunteers are the ones that help build that rig because our winter crew is, two or three people that work down there. That's it. So it's something that I think a lot of times gets understated how much the volunteers do. And a lot of that's because the volunteers, they want to be a part of it and they're happy to be there. And, it doesn't get put out as much as it could be.
Yeah.
And well, I think it's really cool and awesome that, like, you being, you know, chief mate, that you, like, really comprehend that and you are, like, so thankful. I mean, I'm sure that's probably what comes off. That's why all the volunteers like coming back, right? Because you're the one who's like, no, I like you. I need you.
Yeah, but it's not. If Billy wasn't around, we'd probably, you know, people would still.
No, it's not as nice as you. Be like, well, I don't know.
It's about the ship. It really is. Yeah. But it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not about, you know, me just being thankful that the people are down there.
Yeah.
It's everybody's thankful that the people are down there. And you want people to be down there. And it really is about the connection to Niagara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the crew is temporary.
Right.
And the professional crew is temporary. The volunteers are not. The volunteers are forever.
Right.
It might be different people in the volunteer corps, but the volunteers will always be a part of the ship. Whereas, you know, the professional crew is going to change year to year, you know, and there'll always be somebody there to be the professional crew to sail the ship, you know, full time.
Right.
But the volunteer corps are the ones that will always be there.
Yeah.
And that's what matters. And that's what keeps the ship going. That's what builds that consistency in how we do things. Because you always have, you know, in 2008, we had almost entirely new crew. And there was only two or three people that ever sailed on the ship before. But our volunteers had sailed on the ship before, and they were able to help our professional crew learn Niagara.
That's incredible.
And, you know, they may not have the experience in sailing that our professional crew brings or their credentials, and our professional crew very easily and quickly will pick it up and be very good at their jobs, but the volunteers help them with the sort of, you know, this is how we, you know, do below decks cleanup, or, you know, we keep the paintbrushes over here.
Right.
Just the simple things that provide that consistency and that continuity in how we do things. And and that's what makes – one of the things that makes Niagara great.
Yeah. There's awesome. There's also turnover. Volunteers become crew members. And
yes.
Especially, Sydney. Did she start out as a
– Yes, Sydney volunteer? Started off as a 15-year-old volunteer in 2005. She didn't sail the 2005 season. She started off that winter, and then she sailed in 2006, and she's been sailing on the ship ever since. She was an apprentice, trainee again in 2007, apprentice in 2008, and she was on the professional crew starting in 2009, and she's been in AB the past 3 years. And another great crew member that has, and what's great about Sydney too is she's from Erie.
Mm.
She's, you know, 100% from Erie, and you know, saw the ship and started sailing on the ship and now is part of our professional crew. And it was something she always wanted to do. My wife is the same kind of thing. She, you know, from Erie, always saw Niagara and always wanted to be a part of the ship. And, you know, she went through this process of working in the gift shop, you know, working in the office just to be a part of what was going on down there until eventually she started sailing on the ship. And then, you know, her last season on Niagara, she was finally part of the professional crew. And she achieved this goal, you know, somebody from Erie always seeing Niagara and then getting to sail as professional crew. And, you know, Sydney's like that too. And we have, you know, lots of people that have come up through the ranks as volunteers and then become professional crew and then made this their career. There's a lot of tall ship sailors in the fleet that got their start here in Erie.
That's awesome. I mean, I think like the Niagara, much like a lot of the other things in Erie, are just some of the things that people just take for granted and forget about. And then like, oh, it's tall ship week. Cool. Great. But like, it's such a part of Erie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's so underappreciated, I feel, that sometimes. I mean, obviously you guys are doing it with like the recruiters and stuff like that. But like, I feel like there's a lot of things in Erie that are just like, we have it. That's a thing that we have. But no, it's like, no, this is an incredible thing that we have.
It truly is.
Right.
I mean, to have a nationally known, you know, and sometimes worldwide known ship right here in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Right.
I mean, we really do have something special here. I mean, this isn't a 45-foot day sail boat that just sails off of Dobbins Landing. This is the real deal. This is a 100%, square rig sailing vessel sailing right here in Erie, Pennsylvania. And this is where she should be sailing.
Right.
Because this is where the ship is from. and we have the opportunity to sail all over the Great Lakes and tell the story of the U.S. Brig Niagara and of Erie, Pennsylvania, and why Erie and the ship are so significant to our national history.
Right.
It really means something, and it's important. And the more people look into it, the more people realize just how important it is.
I think that's a great place to end it.
I think so, too.
Awesome.
Thanks, Billy.
Yeah, this has been awesome.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I'm glad you guys invited me over.
Yeah. We should have I would love to do a tall shit podcast, man. Travel the seas and interview people. Yeah. Hang out and chat.
Just hanging out.
Because this podcast is basically hang over some beers and shoot the shit. Okay.
Awesome. Cool.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you.
It was cool. The sweat of God, the green grass has finally grown to a set of elephants.
Let me go.